This message was given at Grace Community Church in Minden, Nevada. At the end, we will give information about how to contact us to receive a copy of this or other messages.
Recommended reading on the outline here. So let me start by, I can't do better than to recommend this two-volume set, George Whitfield, The Life and Times of the Great Evangelist of the 18th Century Revival. It's by Arnold Dallimore. And it's simply the best work that I've found on George Whitfield. Also, for those who are a little bit who feel a little daunted by the size of the two-volume, Dallimore also writes a single volume, which only has a couple hundred pages in it. And although it's his intention, as he gives in the introduction, that hopefully he makes you hunger for the two-volume, it is a good, shorter summary of Whitfield's life. So, George Whitfield was born in December 1714. He was born in the Bell Inn in Gloucester. His parents were the proprietors of the Bell Inn, and he was born the youngest of seven. He had five elder brothers and a sister before him. Thomas died when George was only two. And Elizabeth took over the ownership and the running of the inn, and indeed she was able to keep it about just as prosperous and even perhaps more so than when they were running it as a team. George was early slated in the family as being able to go to the university and perhaps even to enter the ministry, and indeed in his youth he often said that what he wanted to be was to be a minister. He had the typical unregenerate boyhood that we all have. He went in, he felt that it was no crime to steal from his mother. He often did steal and then went and fulfilled his sensual desires by buying tarts or fruits or whatever else. But some of the money that he stole, he went and he gave to the poor. And some of the books that he stole were religious devotionals. And so even when he was stealing and even mocking the local preacher, he was considering the life of the ministry. Early on, Whitfield had a disease which was not properly cared for and gave him, it wasn't not really enough to be called cross eyes, but from ever since his childhood, he had squinting, and indeed, this was something that he was made fun of by his critics later on. In one play that was mocking Whitfield, they called him Dr. Squintum, and it was something that got a lot of insults. With Whitfield, without a father and with this physical defect, we can imagine that he had a lot of low self-esteem as a child. But when Whitfield was eight, his mother Elizabeth remarried. She remarried Capel Longdon, and this was unfortunately an unhappy marriage. Capel tried to take over the ownership of the inn, even though Thomas, George's father, had specifically said that half of the inn was to go to the children when they started turning 14. And under his influence, the inn quickly started running down, and it wasn't near as prosperous. At this time, even though George had been slated to go to the university and stuff, he started working in the inn in order to help out his mother and try and help meet the bills and everything. When he was in school, even at this beginning of his life, he had great oratory skills. And the city council would come annually to investigate the school he was in, and he was always chosen to give the speeches before the city council. He was very much interested in plays, and when this was found out, his master started writing some plays of his own, and Whitfield played many a part, sometimes so excited about learning his roles that he would stay home from school trying to memorize his roles. And so even at an early age, an unconverted early age, we can see some of the things that the Lord later developed into a great and wonderful preacher in the future. Now this was, as I said, it was an unhappy marriage, and Elizabeth eventually left Capel Longdon and lived apart for the rest of her life. Whitfield's eldest brother had taken a position of apprenticeship underneath Capel, and there was a dispute between George and his eldest brother's wife, and so George left and went to live with his mother for a time. And it's at this time that when all hope was given up as far as George being able to enter the university, they found out about what's called a servitorship. And basically what that is a boy goes to the university, and he's basically somewhat of a slave, or not really slave, but say servant to three or four other wealthier boys, and by blackening their shoes and whatever errands they have for him, maybe even involving some of their homework, he earns his own pay as far as being able to go to the university. And so when they found out about this, Elizabeth quickly turns to her son and says, "Will this do for you?" And George goes, "By all means." And he goes off to Oxford. And George is having a lot of convictions about his own spiritual status, and he starts doing a lot of self-denial, very active in studying the Word. In fact, he already knew Latin by this time. He was at age 16. He was reading the Greek New Testament, doing his Bible studies from that, and so simply amazing. I can't even imagine the benefits of being able to read Greek at such an early age. But Charles Wesley is also at Oxford at this time, and Charles Wesley is not a servitor. There was a distinct class distinction. Servitors were not to talk or approach anybody else. But Charles Wesley notices George Whitfield's seriousness in his religious duties, and invites George to breakfast. And this is the start of a long relationship and friendship. And Charles Wesley introduces George to what is known by several names. I listed as a holy club here. It was also called Bible moths, Bible bigots. George Wesley led the leading of this club for some time. He simply called it our company. But the Holy Club was an organization that was basically geared to earn their salvation. And by very methodical means, they wanted to take hold of every moment, not let a minute slip by. And they were very studious at the meetings they would have. They would read from maybe some of the Founding Fathers' works or other religious books. They would have Bible studies from the Greek New Testament. They went and they would have charity works for prisons and for, I think they at one time they started a school for the children of prisoners, and this was all supported by their own monies and charity. And I want to make it clear that this was not really an evangelical organization. The members of the Holy Club very much, as far as viewing the communion, they were very much closer to Rome than to Protestant beliefs. They looked upon the works of the early church fathers almost upon par as the Bible. They knew nothing of salvation or justification by faith alone. They were specifically doing these things in order to try and get salvation. But while George Whitfield was in the Holy Club, he came across a book by Henry Scogel called The Life of God and the Soul of Man. And while reading this book, he realizes his need to be reborn, to be made a new creature. And he prays a prayer at this point. He says, "Lord, if I am not a Christian or not a real one, for Jesus Christ's sake, show me what Christianity is, that I might not be damned at last." And now realizing his need for the new birth, but he doesn't know how to become reborn. And so, naturally, since he's come from a works-based background, He tries more works. He deprives himself of almost everything. He's eating nothing but the coarsest of breads, and that seldom. Walking out on cold nights and going out and praying in the wild until it says his hand was like black. It was so cold, I guess. And he goes and intentionally he's trying to give up everything he can. And even he gives up the Holy Club. This was like where his friends were, his only friends. And he gives that up. He figures, I've got to give up everything I can to try and earn this, right? Maybe that would be the one last thing that would allow me to be reborn. And eventually, he basically deprives himself into a sickbed. And he's walking, trying to walk upstairs to his bed. And he realizes he can barely make it up there. And he lets his tutor know. And his tutor calls for a physician, and he's basically confined to bed. And it's at this point in time, after he's done everything that he can possibly do, that he realizes that he must simply take Christ by faith. And this is the point at which he's converted. The first one of the Holy Club to be converted. And he returns to Gloucester, his hometown, to recuperate. Being the son of the proprietors of the Bell Inn, and it being a very prosperous inn, he had grown up with the son of the mayor, and so he ends up staying at the mayor's house during this time as he's recuperating. And he does a lot of in-depth Bible study at this time, and typically, I mean, he'd read the English version, then he'd read the Greek version, then he'd go through and see what Matthew Henry had to say, and then he'd pray over every line. It's something distinctive that he did. And it was very much intense. And later on, when he's preaching maybe 40, maybe 60 hours a week, you can see where he got all of his material from, was from this early biblical study that he did. Also, he's very eager now and very bold to go out and evangelize. He goes and he starts speaking at the prisons. He forms a religious society that meets and he exhorts them. He goes and some people are starting to give him some money, which he then gives to the poor. He also goes and gives reparation for some of the things that he stole earlier. He's noticed by the people very, very heavily, especially in his exhortations that he's giving. And there's a lot of encouragement for him to enter the ministry. And indeed, the bishop actually calls him and says that it's not his practice to ordain anyone until they're like, I think Whitfield was around 21 or so, and he says it's not his practice to ordain anyone who's not a couple years older, but whenever you're ready to be ordained, come on over and I'll ordain you. So this puts George Whitfield in a sense of really dread. He sort of dreads the ministry. And so, it's really interesting because the boy who had played at being a minister now realizes the intense responsibility of the minister. And it's this responsibility that he's so concerned about. And so he puts it off for some time, and he goes and he prays very fervently, Lord, don't let me make a mistake by entering the ministry. But eventually he feels that he'd be disobeying God to delay any longer. And so he goes to the bishop and he is ordained. And actually, I sort of skipped a little bit there. He actually sort of did pray for a sign that this was the Lord's will, and that was that feeling that it was necessary to finish his degree at Oxford before he was ordained. He prayed that the Lord would supply the money for him to go back to Oxford, and the money came. One man gave him a horse so that he could ride over. Other people started giving him monies, and pretty soon he had enough to go back to Oxford. And indeed, he had other reasons to go back to Oxford, because at this time the Wesleys were no longer in Oxford. They had gone to Georgia to be missionaries. And so he was asked to come and take over the leadership of the Holy Club. And so he returns to Oxford. He was ordained, and back then there was still like two stages of being ordained. You're ordained firstly as a deacon, and then later on, about a year later, you would be ordained as a priest. And so he goes back to Oxford, and one of his acquaintances from the Holy Club before is pastoring a church in London, and he asks Whitfield to come and take his place for a period of time, for 2 months. And so Whitfield goes, and he's an instant sensation with the people. People are trying to crowd in to the churches. At the end of 2 months, he returns to Oxford. Immediately, someone else asks him to take his place, and this is at Dummer. And during this period of time, John Wesley in Georgia is losing some of his helpers that he had come with him. He needs some help. So he's sending out letters, and he sends one to George Whitfield, urging Whitfield to consider coming over to Georgia and aiding him. And George Whitfield goes into prayer and considers it. Later on, he gets another letter at the period of time when he's at Dummer. And he decides at this time that it's the Lord's will for him to go and be a missionary to Georgia. So he starts tying up some of the loose ends. He gets somebody to take over the leadership of the Holy Club, and he starts to say goodbye. He goes back to Gloucester, and immediately he's called upon to preach on Sunday. After preaching on Sunday, he finds that he has to preach every day in the week and twice on Sunday. And then going to London, he finds that General, I believe it's Oglethorpe, who is basically the man who started off the colony in Georgia, desires that Whitfield return with him at the same time. It's going to be a delay of about a year. And so Whitfield is quickly asked in London to preach there. People are trying to flock in the doors. Sometimes thousands or hundreds were turned away. And Whitfield preaches for some period of time, finally decides that he can't wait any longer. It's been about a period of 4 months. And he goes and sets sail for Georgia. And at this time, people would see him in the alleys and come up and hug him, and they'd be weeping because he was leaving. And so he leaves for Georgia on the Whitaker, and he actually meets up as he's in the harbor at Deal. John Wesley is in the harbor as well, returning from Georgia. John Wesley states that his prime reason for going to Georgia was the conversion of his own soul. And he's disappointed at this time that he feels even a deep, dark despair because he has not been able to achieve this purpose. He has met some German missionaries, the Moravians, which play a large part in his life, and they have asked him, "Are you born again? Have you been renewed?" And he has to answer no. He hasn't experienced that. And so he is returning back to England, very much dejected. In fact, I should say that one of the reasons he's leaving is also because he made an unwise decision regarding, there was a lady in Georgia who he was seeing. This lady, seeing that John Wesley wasn't going to make up his mind desire in respects to marriage, goes and marries somebody else. And John Wesley goes and doesn't allow her to take communion. And then her husband goes and sues him for defamation of character, and there's a warrant out for his arrest. So he splits the country, literally, and comes back to England. But anyway, they meet up, and they're both in the harbor at Deal. And John Wesley feels some responsibility towards George Whitfield in calling him to Georgia in the first place. And another thing that he got from his Moravian friends is the casting of lots. And so John Wesley casts a lot. And he states, he gives the answer to George Whitfield, saying that he asked God what Whitfield should do, and this was his answer, what he'd received about the casting of this lot. Well, George Whitfield can't very well turn around. He's got the hold of his ship stocked with all sorts of utensils and food things for the poor in Georgia. And so he says no, and he continues on. And I'd really like to go into his trip on the Whitaker. It is just simply wonderful. But he gets up and he reads on the deck. He's in the Church of England. He reads prayers morning and evening. And the people on the ship let him know in no uncertain terms that they consider him to be an imposter, and that and they don't treat him with any respect at all. I mean, George Whitfield mentions a one gentleman who is just swearing up a storm right next to him, and with no consideration for George. And so at this time, one of George's prayers is, Lord, let me take them with a holy guile. And he does. He starts visiting the sick, and as he's got all these foodstuffs and things on his hands, he might give them a little sage tea or maybe some fruit or something of the sort. And so he's visiting the sick. Along with his prayers, after 4 days, he starts a catechism class for the soldiers. And let me say that on this ship were several soldiers who were being taken over to Georgia to bolster up the defenses in case of the Spaniards attacking from Florida. And so there's a lot of soldiers on board, and he starts a catechism class for them. And while there's only about 6 or 7 to start off, within a week he's got 20 there. He starts giving sermons along with his reading of the prayers. And at this time, he starts visiting with some of the people, having breakfast or a dish of coffee with the captain. He stays up late at night to be on watch with a maid or something, and so he starts these associations, and he starts a catechism class for some of the women who are there, and a Bible study. And now the captain of the ship, noticing some of the positive things that are resulting from what George is doing, offers him the use of his cabin, since he realizes that George really has no place to prepare his sermons or anything else like that. And he mentions something to the cabin. It's unfortunate that the men should have prayers, and yet the people in the great cabin go without. And so he starts reading prayers in the cabin. And after some days of reading prayers in the cabin, the captain asks, well, you know, don't just read a prayer, give us a sermon too. So now he's giving a sermon in the cabin, and eventually the captain becomes somewhat affected in his own soul and becomes concerned for his men. And he sets up chairs with planks on them along the boat, and it becomes a large floating chapel. at this time, they stop over at Gibraltar, and they're going to pick up some more soldiers. And Whitfield is just simply loved at Gibraltar again. In fact, when he's leaving Gibraltar, several of the soldiers going to Georgia are begging to go on the same ship as George Whitfield. There were actually 3 ships, and they wanted to go on the same one as George Whitfield. And several others were offering him gifts of eggs or figs and coming and telling him of the good he's done to their soul. And so now they leave for Gibraltar, and they're going to Georgia. And now there's besides the captain of the ship, there's also a military captain. And eventually what's happening, George Whitfield is beginning to examine everybody personally, you know, what evidence or what assurance do you have of your faith and all these things. He starts a little zealous, perhaps, in any book that he finds that is unworthy, he tosses over the side and places a good solid book underneath it. Along with he ditches some playing cards and things too. But and when he preaches now, the 2 captains stand one on either side of him. There's a command for a drum to be beaten in the morning to gather all the people together for the worship service. And the 2 other ships draw alongside so they can hear too. And it's really wonderful. Finally, they do reach Georgia, and again he gives a wonderful sermon on God's providence in letting them reach the Americas, and many of the soldiers again coming up to him and proclaiming the good that he's done for their own souls. Showing his unregenerate state, one of the sailors there comes weeping and repenting of his sins to Whitfield. Another man who was one of Whitfield's great oppressors is asks for leave from his military service so he can go and become a minister. It's just wonderful. Now he's in Georgia, and his congregation now numbers about 1,000. Now he was preaching to around congregations of up to 20,000 in England, and now he's gone to this small association of 1,000. And quickly, there's a skeptical eye cast upon him as they look to see whether some of the traits that was in John Wesley is going to be in George Whitfield too. But he quickly wins the hearts of the people, and they offer to build a house for him, and pretty soon the number of people coming to the church is more than the church can hold. And while there, George Whitfield is greatly affected by the sight of many orphans who are there in Georgia. Georgia's a very, this is the newest of the new world, and it's a very harsh environment, and many parents have died and left these orphans, and his heart is touched by this. And so he decides that he is going to build an orphan house there in Georgia. Now, this is really an undertaking that affects his entire life, because at this time Georgia is basically filled with people who came from the debtor's prison. Many of them don't wish to work, and it's a harsh environment, and there's not really the financial base to run a charity of this size. And Whitfield is very much placed under debt for the majority of his lifetime for the orphan house. And but he returns to England, and his plan is, all those churches that were opened to me in London and everywhere else, I'll go back, and this time I'll take collections for the orphan house. And at the same time, he returns, and he has the second phase of his ordination done, where he becomes a full-fledged minister now in the Church of England. But there's some conflict now. And this comes from a couple different aspects. One is that experiencing the new birth himself, Whitfield preached much upon the necessity of being born again. He came to see from a logical conclusion that anyone who was regenerate was his brother, and any man who was not his brother. And so he tends to associate with some of the dissenting ministers who aren't in the Church of England, and some of the people who are really big into the Church of England are really upset that he would show this favor towards them. Other things are that he's taking in these offerings, and people are just giving to the bottom of their purse sometimes. And in short amounts of time, he is gathering up some large offerings, and people are jealous that he's able to do this. And there's even the charge that you're pulling all the money out of our congregations. And also something, Whitfield went and sent back a journal of everything that he was doing while he was in Georgia. And unfortunately, there was so much demand at this time for anything from Whitfield's pen, his sermons that he had delivered. There were 9 sermons at that time that were published and republished multiple times by multiple publishers. But also, this journal comes back, and a publisher gets a hold of it, and he publishes this. And now this journal, which was meant only for the ears of some of his friends and places where you can say things maybe a little bit more openly, maybe say some things that you wouldn't say, especially in something that would be published, is published. And quickly, there's in a small moment of time, there's 3 different publishers publishing them. And so there are people who take affront at some of the things he says in his journals, which really should never have been published. So there's this conflict. And he finds that a lot of the churches that were open to him before are no longer open to him. And also, when preaching at some churches, he also finds that we're turning away as many people as we have in the church. And there's people crowding around, trying to listen at the windows. And Whitfield is considering what's rather a drastic option at this time. And that is outdoor preaching. I mean, this is something of a revelation here. It could be termed enthusiastic, and in those days, the word enthusiastic carries the connotations of fanatic to us today. And so he doesn't go into this quickly. He takes his time and he thinks about it. And Howell Harris at this time is doing outdoor preaching in Wales, and George Whitfield starts to exchange letters with him. And he's playing with this idea of stepping out and doing open air preaching. And there's one way in which the Church of England would give a stamp of if not approval, then at least it would be okay to preach outdoors if it was an unchurched people, if there was no church around. And so Whitfield goes to a place called Kingswood, which is just filled with miners, heavily a lot of coal mines there. And these miners were a really rough people. In fact, that sometimes they would get fed up to such a point that they would actually go and they would pillage some of the neighboring towns. So, I mean, this was not your average congregation. But there's no church there. So it's allowed to do open-air preaching. He comes and he goes to Kingswood. And he goes and he calls the people out of their minds. And he goes and he stands on a hill and he does his first open-air preaching. And pretty soon he's starting from small congregations. Pretty soon he has congregations of up around 20,000. And he goes to other neighboring communities too around that area. And in fact, one of the more famous quotes by Wesley is one in which he states that the first signs of really reaching the people was seeing these white gutters on their faces, because they would come from their coal mines with black faces, and they were dirty wherever they went. It was their life almost, that they couldn't get away from it. But when they were affected by the preaching, their tears would make these white gutters on their faces. And now Whitfield's mission here was, once again, he returned to England to get the monies necessary to raise his orphan house. And so he realizes that this is only a temporary thing he can do here, and yet it's grown to such a magnitude that he really needs somebody to take his place now. Who is going to preach to these people when he goes back to Georgia? And after doing a little searching, it really only comes down to one man, and that's John Wesley. John Wesley, by this time, has now been converted. And George almost forces him into open-air preaching. John really is not looking forward to this, but George goes and he sends horses to London for John to ride back. He puts in the paper that John Wesley's coming, you know, and he basically sets circumstances up so that John can't refuse. And so John comes, and Wesley, I intend for you to preach this next coming Sunday at such and such a location, or whatever else. And John is basically forced into the open air preaching, and he takes over the ministry there at Kingswood and those surrounding areas. Now Whitfield returns to London, and now he takes the next step in his open air preaching. He preaches where there are churches. And one thing that he tries to do is he figures that if he asks the church for permission and they deny him, that, well, it's okay to preach outdoors then. And so this is the rule that he starts to follow in this period of time. And he gets some very large congregations going in London. And now he's got the same problem, doesn't he? He needs somebody to take over his ministry again. I mean, and this time it can't be John Wesley. He's already taken now, and so he brings Charles Wesley out, and once again he's basically forced into the pulpit there, the outdoors pulpit, and Wesley does not fall into the mold quite as well. In fact, even when he is preaching at times, he's writing letters saying, you know, I can't take this much longer. But he eventually does come to accept open air preaching and takes over George's ministry there. Meanwhile, over John Wesley is starting to experience in his congregations some emotional effects, what Charles Wesley calls fits. But John Wesley takes these as signs that God is affirming his ministry. And also, when George Wesley left, he said, well, don't preach anything against predestination, because the people here are heavily favored for it. George Whitfield tells John Wesley not to preach anything against predestination because the people are heavily favored for it. But John can't really stand this. And so there comes a point in time, and I believe he's in a prison at this time, and he's speaking. He speaks heavily against predestination. And he prays and he says, Lord, if this be your will, then confirm it by signs following afterwards. And some people have the emotional effects afterwards. And this is the Lord, right? Confirming what he's doing is correct. And then we remember that John Wesley was also involved in the casting of lots. So he has prepared a sermon against predestination, and he casts a lot to determine, is this really the Lord's will or not? And the lot he draws says, preach and print. And so, well, this is the Lord's will, obviously. So he goes and preaches his first sermon against predestination. And I'd like to read a portion of that, if I could. He says, it is a doctrine full of blasphemy, of such blasphemy as I should dread to mention, but that the honor of our gracious God and the cause of truth will not suffer me to be silent. In the cause of God, then, and from a sincere concern for the glory of his great name, I will mention a few of the horrible blasphemies contained in this horrible doctrine. And, I mean, he goes on, one thing that I want to mention. He says, such blasphemy this, as one would think, make the ears of a Christian to tingle, but there is yet more behind, for just as it honors the Son, so doth this doctrine honor the Father. It destroys all his attributes at once. It overturns both his justice, mercy, and truth. Yea, it represents the most holy God as worse than the devil, as both more false, more cruel, and more unjust. And later on, he goes and he's addressing the devil, and he says, thou fool, why dost thou roar about any longer? Thy lying in wait for souls is as needless and as useless as our preaching. Hearest thou not that God hath taken thy work out of thy hands, and that he doth it more effectually? Thou, with all thy principalities and powers, canst only so assault that we may resist thee, but he can irresistibly destroy both body and soul in hell. Thou canst only entice, but his unchangeable decree to leave thousands of souls in death compels them to continue in sin till they drop into everlasting burnings. Thou temptest, he forceth us to be damned, for we cannot resist his will. Thou fool, why goest thou about any longer seeking whom thou mayest devour? Hearest thou not that God is the devouring lion, the destroyer of souls, the murderer of men? And such he represents the doctrines of grace. This is only 4 weeks since Whitfield has asked him to take charge of his congregations and asked him not to preach against predestination. John Wesley also comes out with another unique doctrine, and this is Christian perfectionism, believing that while we're here on the earth that we can live in a sinless state. And with these distinctive doctrines, John Wesley has now differentiated himself from George Whitfield. And because of also the signs of God during his preaching, he develops quite a following himself. George Whitfield hears about John Wesley's sermon against predestination. He urges him that the best course would be for both of us to remain silent. He doesn't want any disunity or any discord or any conflict between them. And he feels that the best way would be if they would both remain silent on this doctrine. And while George is waiting for his boat so he can leave back to Georgia again. He stays at the house of, and I probably won't pronounce her name right, but it's Elizabeth Della Motte. And this comes into play a little bit later, but let me just mention that he spent several periods of time there and got to know her fairly well. This time, when he goes to America, he doesn't go straight to Georgia, but he lands in Delaware. And he goes in, and while the rest of his company sails down to Georgia, he preaches his way down to Georgia and gets to know America a little bit. He meets Ben Franklin at this time. When he does finally, I'll quote something from Ben a little later, I hope. When he does finally get down to Georgia, he builds his orphan house, with which he calls Bethsaida, which means a house of mercy. He goes on a series of tours from Georgia while he's in America at this time, and Delamore calls them the spring, summer, and fall tours. But before he leaves, he goes and he writes a proposal of marriage to Elizabeth Della Motte. And then he leaves for his spring tour, and he has to wait. We're used in our microwave society to very quick response, but his letter had to sail over, the response had to sail back, so he's in for a time of intense suspense here. Then he goes up, and on his spring tour, he also meets Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards goes and counsels him against a particular, a fault that Whitfield had, and that's that Whitfield was much to giving some of his impressions divine authority, and it was almost treating it like a source of revelation, that he would have this great impression, and he would treat it as if it was a special message from God, Edwards. Responds to him. And he says, this is when Edwards is speaking about this event some years later, but he says, "I indeed have told several persons that I once purposely took an opportunity to talk with Mr. Whitfield alone about impulses, and have mentioned many particulars of our conference together on that head, that I told him some reasons I had to think he gave too great heed to such things, and have told what manner of replies he made, and what reasons I offered against such things. And I also said that Mr. Whitfield did not seem to be offended with me, but yet did not seem to be inclined to have a great deal of discourse about it, and that in the time of it he appeared not to be convinced by anything I said." Later on, he is convinced, and we'll find out why. But then, after these tours, And one of the great, the difficult things in preparing this lesson is that there's a lot of Whitfield's life that you have to leave out. So we won't go into a lot of the things he does here. But he returns back to England, he doesn't really receive the warm welcome that he desires. Let's see here. He says that many of his former hearers are rushing by with their fingers in their ears now. And several of them later informed him this had been Wesley's instruction to them to prevent them from hearing heretical doctrine. So Whitfield's chief sorrow, however, arose from the opposition of John and Charles Wesley. "Many, very many of my spiritual children," he wrote, "who at my last departure from England would have plucked out their own eyes to have given them to me, are so prejudiced by the dear master, Wesley, dressing up the doctrine of election in such horrible colors that they will neither hear, see, nor give me the least assistance. Yes, some of them send threatening letters that God will speedily destroy me." Not quite the warm welcome he was hoping for. And let me read. I was quite affected by this. This is a hymn that Charles Wesley wrote defending against predestination, basically. It says, "For every man he tasted death, he suffered once for all. He calls as many souls as breathe, and all may hear the call. A power to choose, a will to obey, freely his grace restores. We all may find the living way and call the Savior ours. Thou canst not mock the sons of men. Invite us to draw nigh. Offer thy grace to all and then thy grace to most deny. Horror to think that God is hate. Fury in God can dwell. God could a helpless world create to thrust them into hell. Down there an endless death to die from which they could not flee. No, Lord, thy inmost bowels cry against the dire decree." And so this is the type of opposition that that George Whitefield is receiving at this time. Also, while he was on the trip over to America, he was very much deepened in his understanding of his own sinfulness, and of course then correspondingly to that, God's grace. And he was very much confirmed in his Calvinistic doctrines, and he finds that to stay, he cannot stay silent any longer. And John Wesley isn't staying silent. At this time, he has already published his Against Predestination sermon. And so George Whitefield publishes an open letter to John Wesley. And if you do buy the two-volume set by Arnold Dallimore, you'll find that it is reproduced in the whole, in the second volume. And reading it is just wonderful. George Whitefield always was such a peaceable man. Whenever he responded back to people, it was with such love and affection. You rarely, if not never, heard the bite and or bitterness. And you compare John Wesley's sermon, and he didn't really use any logic or anything but emotional response. And then you compare it to the logic in George Whitefield's, and it's just simply marvelous. I have to recommend it for you. And of course, this does nothing to improve the relationship between Whitefield and the Wesleys. At this time, he takes his first trip to Scotland, and really, there's only one thing I wanted to mention here, just because I found it so amusing. But he's traveling with a companion of his, and he goes, and this poor widow is in some need of some funds, and he goes, and I think he gives her like 5 sovereigns. And his friend sort of says, you know, that's really more than you could afford. You really shouldn't have given that much. And going down the road here, a highwayman comes along and takes their money, and when he goes off, George Whitefield is saying, well, isn't it a lot better that the widow should have it than that he should have it? But what's also funny is the highwayman comes back, and he wants George Whitefield's coat. So he takes George Whitefield's coat, and George gets the ragged one that the highwayman was wearing. And so they travel on, and then they see the highwayman coming back again. But this time they're fairly close to some cottages, and by riding hard, they make it to the cottages, and the highwayman, of course, goes away somewhat sad. But and the reason why he was feeling so badly when George was taking off his coat was he found that there was probably about 100 sovereigns in the old ragged jacket of the highwayman. So the Lord repaying Whitefield for his 5 sovereigns, I think. This time also, we mentioned Howell Harris a little bit before, and he was the preacher in Wales at that time. And at his conversion, he decided that the only marriage he would ever have was to God, and that no one would upset that. Nobody would take that place or threaten it. But he's gone and he's fallen in love with this widow, and now he's in a problem. I mean, they're both very much in love with each other, and yet he will not marry her because he does not want to take away any of his time or attention away from the Lord. And he gets, in fact, let me just read a passage here. Let's if I grab the right book. When Whitfield was visiting Jonathan Edwards, he didn't only receive this encouragement to stop from his impulses, but he also was very much affected by Mrs. Edwards. And this is something he says. He says, "I felt great satisfaction in being in the home of Mr. Edwards. A sweeter couple I have not yet seen. Miss Edwards is adorned with a meek and quiet spirit. She talked solidly of the things of God and seemed to be such a helpmeet for her husband that she caused me to renew those prayers which for some months I have put up to God that he would be pleased to send me a daughter of Abraham to be my wife." And word gets around that Whitfield's looking for a wife. And Howell Harris has this problem. And he says, "I got it. I'll introduce this lady to George Whitfield, and then I won't have any temptation to marry her, and Whitfield will have this godly daughter of Abraham that he was looking for." And so he goes. Whitfield is introduced to Miss Elizabeth James, and while he's in Scotland, he's corresponding with her. And he comes back, and she raises some objections here. I mean, she was very much in love with Howell Harris, and realizing at this time, I mean, it's something of an honor to be wooed by George Whitfield. Indeed, one of the biographers says that Whitfield was as odd a wooer as ever wooed, and indeed he probably was. But now she has to make a decision about who she's going to marry, right? Will she wait for Howell Harris, who does not want to ever get married, or will she marry George Whitfield? And she ends up, after 4 days, deciding to marry George Whitfield. So they go off, and Howell Harris is not left out of the picture. It's his duty to give away the bride. Sort of appropriate, really. So they go around, and they're looking for somebody to marry them, and there's so much opposition from the churches at this time that they have to go to five different cities before they'll find a place where they can find somebody to marry them. But then they are married them. And George Whitfield does say later on, "Marry when or whom you will, expect trouble in the flesh." And by all indication, his marriage was not an unhappy one. But I think he labored under some false impressions of the fact that he could get married without marriage affecting his ministry. And he learned that he was wrong. And when he did find that marriage had started to affect his ministry, he was discouraged by that. And that might be some of the things that would cause him to make such a quote. But later on, they do have a son, John Whitfield, and under impulse, George Whitfield states that he will be called John and he will be a great preacher, and he gets this from the account of John the Baptist's birth, and he's applying it to his own son. And unfortunately, I don't even think he lives out the year, John Whitfield. And it's at this time that George Whitfield realizes how wrong he is to trust in these impulses. And indeed, he talks about how terrible it is that he had to learn in this manner, by such a terrible manner. He tends to speak against impulses from then on. I'm trying to shove a lot of Whitfield's life together now, but Howell Harris and George Whitfield had gotten together, and they'd actually done the first combining of ministries. The religious societies that would be formed by Whitfield or by Howell Harris or by John Wesley, whoever else, they weren't meant at first to be separate from the church. It was some place where it could work within the Church of England, and it gradually changed from that. the first thing that sort of molded all these individual societies together was the Calvinistic Methodist Association, which was started with 30 of Howell Harris's societies and about 16 to 20 of George Whitfield's societies. About a year and a half years later, Wesley also started combining some of his societies. At first he called them the United Societies, but later he started using the term Methodists as well. And so we actually see the foundations of two Methodist movements, the Calvinistic Methodist and then the Wesleyan Methodist. And Whitfield does not like all this conflict. And he realizes at this around this time that he's always going to be called back and forth across the ocean to fix some problem or another. In fact, he returns back to America at one point in time because there's a lot of fanaticism and a lot of the emotional effects and things, and he's being blamed for some of it. And he goes back and he does another tour, and he's very he shows by his ministry, basically by his life, that such things are not right and that he was not a source of them. Whitfield was never really one to defend himself. He stated many times that he was he was willing to wait until the Lord revealed all at the final judgment. And it didn't matter what people thought of him on the earth. And at this time, because of his great dislike for the conflict between himself and Wesley's, and also because he realizes that he's going to be called all over the place, he goes and he gives up his leadership of the Calvinistic Methodist Association. And what basically happens is he wants to try and unite the two different movements, and he realizes that John Wesley's personality will not allow him to be second place. So Whitfield states that he is willing to be the servant of every man, and he places himself under John Wesley, and the two movements are united. I can't help but wonder what would happen, or what would have happened, if Whitfield had gone on to continue the Calvinistic Methodist Association, and as it is, all of Methodism basically followed after the Wesleys from this point in time. Now, maybe as much as 22 years before his death, George Whitfield had started to feel effects. He had been preaching one time, and Whitfield was an amazing man. Can you imagine preaching to crowds of 30,000 for 40 hours a week? I mean, to strain your voice to its uttermost to reach that last guy at the back. And eventually, it starts affecting him. And after straining himself sometimes, what he starts to do is he starts to vomit up blood. And this goes on for quite a period of time, actually. And he'll preach, and he'll vomit up blood, and he'll preach again. Doctors are telling him, you got to stop preaching, and he doesn't stop preaching. And eventually, it is the cause of his death eventually. Let me read a few sections here. It says, now the year is 1770. It says, on September 29, on his way to Boston, he reached the town of Exeter. He intended to pass through, but found a great number of people had gathered and were insistent that he stay and preach. This happened a lot to Whitfield. A platform had been prepared in a field, and as he approached it, an elderly gentleman said, "Sir, you are more fit to go to bed than to preach." "True, sir," replied Whitfield, and turning aside and looking up, he stated, "Lord Jesus, I am weary in thy work, but not weary of it. If I have not yet finished my course, let me go and speak for thee once more in the fields, seal thy truth, and come home and die." he goes and he preaches at Exeter, and he continues on his traveling. He's trying to make his way to where he has an appointment to preach. And it says, Whitfield went on to the home of the Reverend Jonathan Parsons. While the family was at supper, he said he was tired, I want to go to bed. He was on a landing on the stairs when the door was opened to admit a host who had gathered outside, and they earnestly requested that he preach. This also happened to Whitfield a lot. He paused, candle in hand, and preached Christ till the candle burned out in its socket and died away. That candle was symbolic of his life, which was also burned out and speedily dying away. Richard Smith, a young man who traveled with him, reported that Whitfield awoke about 2 in the morning and seemed to pant for breath. A good pulpit sweat today, he said, may give me relief. I shall be much better after preaching. Whitfield, it was amazing that sometimes he would have to be lifted up onto his own horse, and yet when he got behind that pulpit, he would be powerfully strengthened. And he felt very much stronger after preaching. Smith told him he wished he would not preach so often, but Whitfield answered, I'd rather wear out than rust out. He woke again at 4. He had got out of bed and opened the window, saying, I am almost suffocated. I can scarce breathe. Mr. Parsons came in, and Smith went to bring the doctor. On my coming back, he stated, I saw death in his face. His eyes were fixed, his under lip drawing inward every time he drew breath. At 7 that morning, Sunday, September 30, 1770, George Whitfield ceased all struggle on earth, and his soul took its flight to the presence of God. He entered the land for which he had been prepared by divine grace, the land for which he had longed and to which he had directed countless numbers of mankind. I did want to cover a couple things that I thought would be better talked about topically than chronologically, and that's, first of all, the relationship between George Whitfield and the slaves in America. When he was going from on his second trip to America, down preaching through the Americas down to Georgia, he noticed how the slaves were treated. And he goes and he writes, they were into long titles back then, it's to the inhabitants of Maryland, Virginia, and North and South Carolina concerning their Negroes. And he states, whether it be lawful for Christians to buy slaves, I shall not take it upon me to determine. But sure I am that it is sinful when bought to use them worse than brutes. And I fear the generality of you who own Negroes are liable to such a charge for your slaves, I believe, work as hard as the horses whereupon you ride. These, after they have done their work, are fed and taken proper care of, but many Negroes, when wearied with labor in your plantations, have been obliged to grind their own corn after they return home. Your dogs are caressed and fondled at your tables, but your slaves, who are frequently styled dogs or beasts, have not an equal privilege. They are scarce permitted to pick up the crumbs which fall from their master's tables. Nay, some, as I have been informed by an eyewitness, have seen upon the most trifling provocation, cut with knives, and have been given up to the inhuman usage of cruel taskmasters, who by their unrelenting scourges have plowed upon their backs and made long furrows, and at length brought them even to death itself. This is really, at that time, the question was around whether the Negro even had a soul. And George Whitfield says a resounding yes. He many times, at one time, a bunch of Negroes had gotten together and requested that he come and preach to them, and he did on the conversion of the Ethiopian. Sometimes at the end of his sermons, he would make particular application points to them. One time when he was sick and lying in bed, they had gathered around his windows and were praying for him. I mean, he had a wonderful relationship with them, and he was so upset to see them used such. And he tried to start another work. He had Bethsaida. Now he wanted to start Nazareth, which was a 5,000-acre place where the Negroes could come and live and be free from their cruel taskmasters. Unfortunately, this effort failed due to finances. We mentioned that Whitfield was largely in debt most of his life for Bethsaida. One of his great supporters at this time died due to a mob had hit him in the head with a stone. and he hadn't adequately prepared his will. Some of the things he had signed up for were not now in the will given to Whitfield, and so Nazareth was a failed program. And later on, I'm sorry to say that although he spoke for the Negroes, he did not speak against slavery. And later on, as part of supporting Bethsaida, he had a plantation there, which he filled with slaves in order to support the orphan house. And I would like to say a little bit about George Whitfield and his preaching. He probably preached somewhere around 18,000 formal sermons. And this is not really counting the exhortations that he would give to the religious societies. And when you take the years of his ministry, this really works out to about 2 sermons a day. It's simply marvelous. He went to America 7 times, to Scotland 15, twice he went to Ireland, and once each he went to Gibraltar, Bermuda, and Holland. He tried to go to Canada and wasn't able to. Whitfield's sermons were first designed to reach the mind of his hearer, then awaken the emotions, and then to finally move their will. He was very, very aggressive in his preaching, and indeed, here's a quote from J.C. Ryle, where he states, "He was the first to see that Christ's ministers must do the work of fishermen. They must not wait for souls to come to them, but must go after souls and compel them to come in. He did not sit tamely by his fireside like a cat in a rainy day, mourning over the wickedness of the land. He went forth to beard the devil in his high places. He attacked sin and wickedness face to face and gave them no peace. He dived into holes and corners after sinners. He hunted out ignorance and vice wherever they could be found. In short, he set on foot a system of action which up to his time had been comparatively unknown in this country, but a system which once commenced has never ceased to be employed down to the present day." His preaching was simple. He spoke the pure doctrines of the faith, and he spoke it in such a way that not only could the Negroes understand and the coal miners understand, but also his words were so fluent, and he was such a fine speaker that he also spoke to the lords and ladies of that time, and indeed he actually held services where there would be congregations of the lords and ladies. So his ministry crossed all ranks. It wasn't specifically one layer of society. It crossed all ranks. He was bold and he was direct. He had an awesome power of description, and he was quick with it. There was one time where, when preaching outdoors, he made the cloud had passed in front of the sun, then a lightning bolt had come down, then the thunder came, and then later on a rainbow. And each time that those things had happened, he quickly made a point regarding his sermon using what had just taken place. Just simply marvelous. And he was very, very earnest. In fact, something else I'd like to quote from Ryle. An American goes to try and to look at one of Whitfield's services. And he says, "The day was rainy, the congregation comparatively thin, and the beginning of the sermon rather heavy. Our American friend began to say to himself, 'This man is no great wonder after all.' He looked around and saw the congregation as little interested as himself. One old man in front of the pulpit had fallen asleep. But all at once Whitfield stopped short. His countenance changed, and he suddenly broke forth in an altered tone. 'If I had come to speak to you in my own name, you might well rest your elbows on your knees and your heads on your hands and sleep. And once in a while look up and say, "What is this battle we're talking of?" But I have not come to you in my own name. No, I have come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts.' Here he brought down his hand and foot with a force that made the building ring. 'And I must and will be heard.' The congregation started. The old man woke up at once. Aye, aye, cried Whitfield, fixing his eyes on him. I have waked you up, have I? I meant to do it. I am not come here to preach to stocks and stones. I have come to you in the name of the Lord God of hosts, and I must and will have an audience. And he had an audience. They rapt attention from then on. So he, once again, speaking with his voice, not only did he have a voice that was powerful enough to reach that last guy in 30,000, and indeed some of his estimations of his congregations, although we think that some might be inflated, one estimation is 80,000. So while having the powerfulness of voice to preach to these far corners of people, he also had the musical and tone in his voice that it was said that he could cause tears to come by pronouncing Mesopotamia. I mean, it was just marvelous. So, I did want to read that one quote from Ben Franklin. Maybe that'll be apt to finish on. But Ben Franklin, when describing his sermon ability, speaking ability, he had a loud and clear voice and articulated his words and sentences so perfectly that he might be heard and understood at a great distance, especially at his audiences, however numerous, observed the most exact silence. And then he goes on to talk about how he computed that by walking backwards until he could just barely hear him, and then figuring that as a radius of a circle and computing that everybody would probably have about 2 square feet that he could probably speak to 30,000. But George Whitfield also learned to use the wind to his advantage, and his voice would be carried on the wind. So it's a wonder to see how many he could preach to using the wind as to his advantage. Benjamin Franklin, he thought it was rather stupid of Whitfield to have the orphanage down in Georgia, where you'd have to bring all the laborers and all the materials and everything down to Georgia. Well, you should probably put the orphanage here in Philadelphia and bring the orphans over here. So because of this, he decides that he's not going to give any money towards the orphan house. And he says, I happened soon after to attend one of his sermons, in the course of which I perceived he intended to finish with a collection. And I silently resolved he should get nothing from me. I had in my pocket a handful of copper, 3 or 4 silver dollars, and 5 pistoles in gold. As he proceeded, I began to soften and concluded to give the coppers. Another stroke of his oratory made me ashamed of that, and I determined to give the silver. And he finished still admirably, but I emptied my pocket wholly into the collector's dish, gold and all. At this sermon, there was also one of our club who, being of my sentiments respecting the building in Georgia, and suspecting a collection might be intended, had by precaution emptied his pockets before he came from home. Towards the conclusion of the discourse, however, he felt a strong desire to give, and applied to a neighbor who stood near him to borrow some money for the purpose. The application was unfortunately made to perhaps the only man in the company who had the firmness not to be affected by the preacher. His answer was, at any other time, friend Hobkinson, I would lend thee freely, but not now, for thou seemst to be out of thy right senses. But he was very much able to move the crowd. He was loved wherever he went. Despite the opposition that he had from the higher levels of the church, the people always loved him, and indeed sometimes they did things that weren't quite right if they found that their church was not allowing him to preach, then they're going to cut the paycheck of their preacher, or they did some things which weren't which Whitfield would probably not condone. But when he was leaving Boston one time on a farewell sermon, there was like 23,000 who attended the sermon, which was more than the inhabitants of the city itself. Another time when he was leaving Boston, they came and they said, we'll build you the largest church in America if you'll just stay here and be our pastor. And when leaving another town soon after that, they offered him 800 pounds a year if he'd just preach there 6 months out of the year. And so he was heavily desired to preach, and many tried to stake him as their pastor, but he kept himself an evangelist and went, like we said, He was the one man who tied the revivals in Scotland and America and England together. He was in all places, and the Lord worked marvelously through him. Marvelously. So, are there any questions that I can try to avoid? John. Let's close in prayer then. Heavenly Father, Lord, I thank you for this evening, and Lord, for these saints that you've gathered under this roof. Lord, I thank you for this series that we've done upon heroes of the faith, Lord. I pray that as they look upon us from the crowd of witnesses, that we might be spurred on to follow in their footsteps and imitate them as they imitated you. And I ask, Father, that we might learn from both their positive examples and their mistakes. I pray, Heavenly Father, that you would protect Brian as he travels and bring him safely to us. I pray that you would be with Dave as he finalizes his sermon for Sunday, and that you would be with him, give him strength in preaching, and may you be with all of our ears as we listen and take away our distractions so that we might concentrate on your word and upon yourself. And Lord, I ask that you would pour out blessings upon the ministry of Grace Church here, and that, Father, we might also be an example to those who follow in our footsteps later on. And Lord, may you watch over us now and make us bold and more faithful servants. In Christ's holy name, amen.
We hope you've enjoyed this message from Grace Community Church in Minden, Nevada. To receive a copy of this or other messages, call us at area code 775-782-6516 or visit our website, gracenevada.com.